Welcome to the podcast of MotorWeek, television's original automotive magazine. MotorWeek is made possible by RockAuto.com. Here's your host, John Davis.
Thank you, Alec Webb. I am John Davis, and welcome to MotorWeek podcast number 61. And around our table in Studio C is our road test producer and two-wheeling reporter, Brian Robinson.
Hello.
Our associate producer, Ben Davis.
Hello.
And our writer, Brandon Holthouse.
Hey, that's me.
Okay, we've got a lot to cover today, and we're going to start off, before we get to our mailbag and to our lightning round, with a new review of a class of vehicles that's increasingly popular, and that's three-row SUV crossovers. Now, we do these kind of comparison tests along with our colleagues at Cars.com and also down at USA Today. And on this particular event, Ben Davis was our rep, and we just basically surveyed the entire landscape. They had seven SUVs and crossovers to choose from. So give us how it all came out, Ben.
We'll do. First of all, it's an incredible opportunity to drive seven back-to-back, because you really get to pick up all the nuances and differences between the two without having to all the dealership interaction that a customer might have to have. So take it from the pros on this one. Here's how
pesky,
it went down.
Pesky little things like salesmen getting in a way.
It would have taken at least a week to do what I did in a day. Seven altogether, and the top four are as follows. In fourth place came in the Dodge Durango. It was my personal favorite.
It's also our MotorWeek choice this year.
Yeah, but on the bad side of that, it is pretty much the only one with a frame, and it does feel a little heavy and trucky on the road, and that was a downfall in some people's scorebooks. Pentastar 3.6, beautiful engine. I love it and everything. Feels a little bit underpowered in this, and the Trans seems to be tuned for massive economy in mind. So
great interior, though. Really nice interior.
Beautifully styled. The materials, tones, all very – everything you touch is premium, soft touch. I mean, it looks like it should be in a different class from the rest of these utes as far as interior goes. Third row, you can fit as many adults as you want to back there as long as you can buckle them up.
So it's a real three-row, seven-passenger?
Seven-passenger, and it's the real deal. I fit back there fine with plenty of headroom, and I could have went for 4 or 5 hours, no problem back there. Well-bolstered, and any seat that you're in is well-bolstered, long-haul supportive. And it gets pretty decent mileage on the highway for what it is. Like I said, it was my choice. That's what I would have bought. But third place, Mazda CX-9. CX-9 has been around for a long time, and it still does everything right. You know, it's still a viable contender. It's that snug driver cockpit kind of feel.
Mm-hmm.
Driver tuned suspension
compared to the rest of them. Yeah,
but it's kind of sports car cool. It's zoom zoom, if you will. And it's the roof slung down low, so there's a little bit of visibility issues. If you're in the third row, you kind of feel like you're in a cell, sort of.
We didn't mention that all of these vehicles had to have a price before destination of under $37,000. So none of them were all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive, right?
That's correct, yeah. They were all
okay, but
they all
were pretty well equipped.
Some of the complaints with the Mazda CX-9 was that even though it is an older model, it kind of lacks some of the electronics that come with the newer models. You think that was why it was ranked a little bit lower than the top two?
That could have been it, too, and it's not the freshest faced on the scene, too. That might have had something to do with
it. Wasn't the greatest face to begin with, either.
But it's got a good – the motor's very responsive.
Yeah, it's fun. It's probably – it's a ball of drive. It probably handles the least like a truck. Coming up in second place, Chevrolet Traverse. I know that's a good favorite around the table.
You know, it's become kind of like the yeoman for the class. You see so many of them. It's a very good vehicle.
It was probably the smoothest driving of the bunch, too. The steering was light and crisp. And it was probably the most comfortable if somebody were to say, you got to do 1,000 miles right now, which one of these are you going to choose? Probably be that one for me.
You didn't get very excited about it.
Well, the seats are a little flat. There's not a whole lot of bolster going on. It's almost sitting like in a movie theater chair a little bit.
Sticky floor and everything.
Hey, 1,000 miles from me, it probably would be.
Don't eat the gum off of that floor.
Yeah. Most of our long terms are like that. So,
It does have a good engine and transmission.
Interior is a little plain. There is room for improvement as far as
it is roomy
like
though.
It was the least expensive in the test, right. So it didn't come very loaded up. I think it was a 1LT, but it wasn't. It didn't have a lot of the bells and whistles, which I actually applaud Chevrolet for sending something that was
probably wasn't smart on their part, though, because that's usually what wins.
Yeah, that's too bad.
A lot of others were pushing the barrier as far as price goes, yeah.
I mean, but it was more realistic of what you see in the newspaper ads.
It had good visibility everywhere you looked, side mirrors, everything. It was really comfortable for if you're going from a small vehicle and you need a three-row vehicle and you're just not used to driving something of that size, this might be the best one for you.
Drum roll, please.
Here we go. Look out. Honda Pilot.
Number one.
Number one.
The box.
And I've always been a fan of the Pilot styling. It's chunky and burly, and it looks
very
rugged,
SUV-ish
tough.
For a crossover.
It looks great. And that look carries over inside, too. It's kind of chunky
industrial
and rugged.
Looking.
And the materials are really great. Everything you touch, every switch you push, every stalk you pull, everything feels really precise and high quality.
Lots of little storage compartments, too. I noticed on some of your tally sheets people were talking about there was a place for everything.
And the cool thing about this is the only one in the test, it had a split hatch where the glass would pop in and of itself, and you could reach in or pull stuff out, and then the whole hatch came up as a big unit as well. It had the only one in the whole group that had any kind of entertainment for people in the back seat, one DVD screen that popped down. So if you had one kid, that'd be great. Or if two kids, they'd have to agree on what to watch. But
that can be tough.
That won't happen.
A lot more options than any of the field, that's for sure.
I should mention that the other three vehicles that were in the test that didn't make it to the finalists were the Toyota Highlander, and I believe it got criticism both for handling and having a lot of hard plastics. The big surprise that didn't make it to the finalists to me was the Ford Explorer, which is all new. But you folks had apparently some problems with the interior. The second row doesn't have any slide feature. And the Kia Sorento, which was the smallest of the group.
Yeah.
I assume that third row seat suffered there.
Definitely suffered there, absolutely.
But all of these were good choices, but I must say I was a little surprised that Honda won, but, you know, it is one you can bank on.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get a lot of grief because our last shootout we did, the Honda Odyssey was the winner, so now everyone's going to say we're
You're partial to Honda.
For the record, I would have chosen Durango.
But and we did, too, for our Driver's Choice Awards, but all of you guys basically came up with this pretty independently, right? And you all tally it up at the end. So it's pretty democratic.
It's pretty legit, yeah.
Do you think that the Pilot won because it was the most family-oriented? I know there's a mirror above the rearview mirror that was a big winner.
CX-9 had that, too. I think Pilot won because it's a great truck, no doubt about it. And at the price point, it just had options that the other ones didn't. Families are going to want.
Because Honda has a reputation as sort of being a bit expensive for what you get and when you look at the Pilot. But actually you felt that, and it was right up against, it was like 36 and change. So you felt that everyone came away and said it had a lot for the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah, that's like one of the oldest designs in there, that in the CX-9, I guess.
And a lot of people have been questioning, including us, of why they stuck with that square styling when everybody else was going swoopy.
I think it was a good thing. A lot of people they still want to portray that image of a rugged SUV, even if they really want to be comfortable and
And some people still drive an SUV because they like an SUV.
Well, that's our three-row SUV crossover shootout for $37,000. Ben, thanks very much for that wrap-up.
Thank you, Ben. That was
I enjoyed
good.
It.
Just a little shaking hands there. Let's move on now and I'll start this one off, Frankfurt Motor Show. Dave Scrivener of our staff and myself were recently at Frankfurt. For those of you that don't know, Frankfurt is the biggest auto show in the fall. Every other year when they're not having their show, the big fall European show is in Paris. This time, unlike the last couple of years, it was more upbeat. The last couple of Frankfurt shows, there hasn't been a whole lot there to get you stimulated. But this time there were a lot more concepts, a lot of them very fanciful. But it was very clear that the Europeans believe that rather than, say, hybrids, like in this country, that pure electrics are the way to go. And a lot of their – actually, most of their concepts were pure electric. And many of them were kind of far out, like the BMW i3 and i8, which is their new sub-brand of electric vehicles. Audi had this small two-seater, the Urban. They're fascinated by this. If anybody remembers the old Messerschmitt, the little three-wheeled, two-person car from after World War II. That dates myself. But this was four wheels. Sort of looks like a bodied motorcycle with four wheels. There was the NILS from Volkswagen, which was a single-seater. But when you really got down to practical stuff, the most important vehicles were we finally saw the production version of the Volkswagen Up, which is their complement to, say, a Mini Cooper. And over in the concept side, I think you had to be impressed with the Ford Evos, which showed the new face of Ford, which went from that kind of elongated drop jaw grill that we see on a lot of Ford products now to really a more Aston Martin kind of sinister look. Very attractive car, very interesting front end, and I think we will see that on other Ford products. So that's my 30-second wrap-up.
The 911, the new 911?
The new 911, which, again, as in past 911s, didn't look – the silhouette is the same, but it is a bit longer. It's still a little bit lower. It has the LED eyebrows on the front end. More power from smaller engines, which seems to be Porsche's way to get more efficiency. Great looking car.
Yeah, I think I'm going out to drive that in a couple of weeks, so that should be cool.
Lucky you.
Was there any concept that you saw and just went, well, I can see that on the road in a year, 6 months maybe?
Oh, concept, no. Unlike the U.S. shows, there might have been, but nothing jumps to my mind. Something, I guess I would have to say the Kia Sport Coupe would be the one car that you saw that you thought, the way Kia goes, getting stuff into production so quick, that could very possibly happen.
It's a rear
happen.
Drive, too, right?
Yeah, it would be their first rear drive car that they've done. Hmm. And they seem to be very serious in the way they've been doing. I mean, basically, they could – I'm not sure what chassis they'd use, but they do have the Tiburon chassis. It is part of the same company and the Genesis chassis. So I guess the Genesis is what I'm thinking of, not Tiburon. So they have the Genesis chassis they could play with since they're owned by the same company. But I would guess of all of them, that would be the one that struck me.
I think the Veloster is rear drive.
I don't think so. I think the Veloster is – no, Veloster is front drive because the Genesis is rear drive.
Yeah. Veloster is small. I've never been to Frankfurt, but I hear just the scale of it.
It's 11 or 12 buildings, each one of them about the size of your average convention center.
Jeez.
And they have cars running back and forth to kind of, you know, help you get back and forth. It's so huge. It's interesting with all of the electric car buzz year after year after year. The only electric cars that I saw that you could actually get in and drive around in, and they were using them as shuttles, were the Opel version of the Chevrolet Volt,
really,
which I thought was kind of interesting. But a good show, a solid show. You all saw the coverage. And I think it showed that there was a lot of enthusiasm coming back to the shows, which we've seen here in the U.S., but obviously it's spilling over to Europe. They don't seem to be as concerned at the auto shows about the European currency crisis as the politicians do. At least they're hopeful. Okay, let me move on past that to a vehicle where the devil is definitely in the details. You've got a new bike to tell us about, Brian?
Yes, the Ducati Diavel.
Which means?
Devil in Bolognese Italian. And it's something new for Ducati and something a little new for us, too. It'll be we do a couple bikes a year, but this time the powers that be here gave me a little more time, so it'll be a little bit longer test, so it should be fun. We were
what makes it different? Ever since you got this bike, you've talked about it's not just a different Ducati, it's a different type of bike.
Well, they consider it a whole new class of bike. Really, it's just their version of a cruiser, much more comfortable.
Like a V-Rod
similar,
or something?
Yeah, V-Rod, Yamaha V-Max, power cruiser. It's 162 horsepower, and it weighs 440-some pounds. Which power-to-weight ratio, if you had a 911 turbo, which has 500 horsepower, it would have to have 1,280 horsepower to have that same power to weight ratio.
That makes it what, 200-300 pounds lighter than a comparable cruiser?
Yeah, at least like half. Mm. Yeah. And, yeah, 2.5 0 to 60.
How much?
2.5 seconds. 0 to 60.
Well, I'd fly right off the back.
That's like a rocket sled.
But it's like a cruiser. It's very comfortable. I did a couple back-to-back 200-mile days on it, and it was fine riding around.
Now,
did
you get a chance to really push the throttle?
No doubt.
That's a silly question.
Did you feel like you were going with that level of acceleration?
Absolutely. It's all you can do to hold on to the thing. Yeah. But with a lot of the, especially the European bikes, almost everything's fuel injected now, and with that, throttle by wire, so they can have different engine mappings. So you can actually, there's three different settings you could limit to actually 100 horsepower, so it wasn't so extreme. And then you could have the full horsepower, but a softer throttle, or then you could go with full throttle. It was intense.
That's pretty cool.
No doubt.
Was it as rare to drive as, say, an Italian exotic? I mean, this really is the exotic brand of bikes, isn't it?
They're definitely the Ferrari of bikes, but this would be comparable to Ferrari building a minivan. Hmm. I mean, that's kind of just something totally out of their what they would normally do, but yet still has all the performance. It'd be like a awesome handling minivan.
It has a price to go with it, right?
Well, $20,000, which, it's obviously pretty expensive. But as far as bikes go, I mean, fully loaded, not even fully loaded, but, a Harley cruiser is 15 to 20 grand. So
it's really priced, in that level of bikes.
Yeah, it's basically to beat a V-Rod. That was like their whole point. Harley wants to make a performance cruiser. This is an actual performance cruiser.
Now, we've
That's
tested
the whole point.
We've tested BMW bikes that have cost more than that.
We just had the BMW Touring bike, the K1600. That was like 24.
Yeah, so.
But that's, again, it weighs twice as much, and it's made for, long-distance touring and stuff like that. But
exciting.
$20,000, not outrageous.
It does seem to me that in all areas of the automotive world that the Italians are making a bit of a comeback, at least in this country, from cars to exotics to bikes. And a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the most modern diesel engines are actually Italian in design. So
we've got Fiats now.
And we have Fiats. Okay, thanks very much, Brian. Let's turn now to our lightning round, and this is where our Motor Week panelists have an opportunity to share their opinions on topics that are making the headlines. They've got 2 minutes to debate, and when they hear this bell that our producer Michelle Parker will ring, the time is up. Here is the question. Under General Motors' new contract with UAW, rather than raising salaries across the board, bonuses have been promised based on the company's profitability.
Wow, we should try that.
Yeah, right. We're not a nonprofit operation. Remember that. It is a good move for the American auto industry as competition becomes increasingly global. Is it a good move for workers? Is it a good move for the industry? Who wants to start?
I don't know a whole lot about it, but it's never stopped me from giving my opinion. But it sounds like a good idea, but I don't know. It's kind of like the big deals they were making in the 80s that sounded like a great deal too, but we're still paying for those. So,
The big thing it does is instead of every 3 years when they go in to negotiate, it will where they would always go in the UAW for more money up front, higher hourly wages and more benefits. This time they're saying, for the most part, our salaries are staying flat. There is a signing bonus, I think, of $5,000, which is significant. But if the company does well, we'll go well. Now, I should note, they've got two levels of workers now. They've got these new workers that only make about half what the experienced workers do.
That's going to be an interesting dynamic.
The new contract includes a fairly substantial raise for them. So, but, in this world of competitiveness, at least the domestic automakers seem to have more control over the cost of building their cars than they ever had before. I mean, the break-even point now for the industry is around 10.5, 11 million versus 16 before. But what about American workers everywhere? I mean, nobody's really gotten raises in the last 3 or 4 years. Is this a good approach for industry to look at? How would you feel about it?
If I worked for them and they're talking about bonuses and everything, I think that sounds great. Mm-hmm. But if they're in if their sales are as good as they're hoping they're going to be for the next year, I mean, it's good that they're already talking about bonuses again. I mean, if sales, if they're not as good, maybe they shouldn't be talking about them.
Do you think this will have an effect on quality, plus or minus?
I'd say plus.
Plus on quality.
If you hear a raise is coming down your way, you're going to put in a little extra effort.
Bonuses. Sure.
Bonus, sure.
Yeah.
It does seem to me we've turned a page. I certainly hope the automakers
I've seen myself doing that anyway.
Can make the best of it. You have.
Right, but you don't have – it's all about profitability. You don't have any control over it. I mean, you can make
– Well, I'd go out and urge my friends to buy.
Right, you can put the shifter in better than anybody else. But
if the quality's bad, people won't buy.
Everybody's going to become a PR guy. Everybody that works there.
I think that's part of the intent.
Well, it should be anyway.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, let's move on to our Motorbeat mailbag, and this one comes from Smoofus from Maryland.
Yeah, this can't be legit.
I apologize if I've got your name wrong or if that's not your real name. There you go. This one comes up over and over and over again, so we're going to take another crack at it. What is the difference between four-wheel drive and all-wheel drive? That used to be a simple answer.
I'll defer to a resident off-roader.
Yeah, from everything I've ever been raised to understand, all-wheel drive, you can't really select. If you can't put it into two-wheel drive only, you're in all-wheel drive all the time.
It's fully automatic.
Fully automatic, yeah. And a lot of these new systems even switch torque from one wheel to the other or from front to back. It's all controlled by a center differential of some kind. And four-wheel drive, of course, it's usually have a higher or low range transfer case that you could switch into. Or you can even put that transfer case in a two-wheel drive. So you have a two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive, high, low, crawling gears and stuff like that. And they're usually accompanied with, traditionally it's been solid axles. A lot of people are going into independent fronts, but traditionally it's on a more heavier truck, heavier duty parts, bigger axles and stuff
like
that.
And really meant for off-roading.
Yeah, very limited traction. Yeah, it's not meant for handling like a lot of these all-wheel drive systems are.
But even that's not true anymore because the Dodge Durango, it actually comes with an off-road capable single speed unit.
I always draw the line at if it's front-wheel drive biased, that's all-wheel drive. If it's rear biased, that's four-wheel drive.
Yeah,
that's
kind of the way to go.
That's probably the more modern definition.
As technology advances, it's going to blur even more.
Yeah, they're constantly blurring. Yeah.
All these systems are totally electronically controlled with very few exceptions. I suppose maybe Jeep or something.
A lot of these all-wheel drive systems have lockers, center locking diff. So in a lot of ways, they'll probably outperform a lot of four-wheel drive systems that we've known to be growing up with.
I think they pretty much all would.
The systems I don't find as useful are the all-wheel drive systems that use only traction control to determine where the torque goes.
Right.
They seem to be more... I mean, they're fine for wet roads, a little bit of snow, but that's about it.
They're not for off-roading. They're just for wet pavement and stuff like that.
Well, thanks very much for that question. The Smoofus answer continues to evolve. What?
Smoofus.
Well, Smoofus, that's our podcast. I want to thank everybody sitting around the table, Brian Robinson, Ben Davis, and Brandon Holthouse. I also want to thank our audio engineer, Jim Bigwood, and our podcast creator, Bob Mixter, and also our producer, the lady with the bell, Michelle Parker. Thank you very much for joining us. Be sure to watch Motor Week on your local public television station. Also, you can catch us on the cable channel Velocity. And tune back in here for another Motor Week podcast real soon. I'm John Davis. Thanks for listening and watching Motor Week.
You've been listening to the podcast of Motor Week, television's original automotive magazine. Motor Week is made possible by RockAuto.com. For additional information on podcasts, videos, and showtimes, visit our website at motorweek.org. And watch Motor Week, television's longest-running automotive series, each week on your local PBS station.